Christmas Lectures. In the spring of 1991, the telephone rang, and a pleasant voice with a gentle Welsh lilt announced, "This is John Thomas." Sir John Murig Thomas, FRS, a scientist of distinction and the director of the Royal Institution, RI, in London, was ringing to invite me to give the Royal Institution Christmas lectures for children, and I went hot and cold as he did so. The warm flush of pleasure at the honour was swiftly followed by a cold wave of trepidation. I immediately knew I would not be able to refuse the commission, and yet I lacked confidence that I could do it justice. I was aware that this renowned series of lectures had been founded by Michael Faraday, who gave them himself on 19 occasions, culminating in his famous exposition of The Chemical History of a Candle. I knew that in recent years the BBC had been televising the series, and the lecturers had included such scientific heroes as Richard Gregory, David Attenborough, and Carl Sagan. If I'd lived in London as a child, I would probably have been in the audience. Sir John understood my fears. He'd given the Christmas lectures himself, and kindly didn't press me for a decision there and then, but invited me to visit the RI to discuss the possibility. I went up to London, and he was as quietly kind as his telephone voice promised, paying special attention as he showed me around to the many legacies and traditions of his personal hero, Michael Faraday. With one of these traditions I was already only too familiar. A year or so earlier, I had been invited to give a Friday evening discourse, another regular custom of the RI, dating back to the 1820s. This particular tradition bristles with intimidating formality. Both the lecturer and the audience are expected to wear evening dress. The lecturer has to stand outside the lecture theatre while the clock strikes the hour. On the last stroke, an official flings open the double doors, the lecturer strides purposefully in, and immediately has to start talking science in the very first sentence, with absolutely no introduction or preamble of the great pleasure to be here kind. That's an admirable tradition. More difficult, the concluding sentence of the lecture must be uttered with decisive finality at the exact moment when the clock begins to strike the following hour. As if that were not alarming enough, the lecturer is literally locked in Faraday's room for the 20 minutes preceding the lecture, having been handed Faraday's own short book on how not to give a lecture. A bit late for that, you might think. I learned that this locking-in tradition began sometime in the 19th century when a lecturer found the formality too much to bear and did a runner at the last minute. Sir John wasn't too sure, but he suspected it was Wheatstone, he of the eponymous bridge. I did read Faraday's notes during my 20 minutes of incarceration, and amazingly, I did manage to round off my lecture exactly as the clock was striking, despite being thrown off my stride by an illusion only gradually dispelled in the course of repeated surreptitious glances in the dim light that a particular dinner-jacketed gentleman in the audience was Prince Philip. I took a deep breath and accepted Sir John's invitation to give the 5 Christmas lectures for a juvenile auditory, to quote Faraday's original rubric. The tradition is to make minimal use of slides, magic lantern I suppose it would have been called in the early days, PowerPoint or keynote now. Instead, there is a heavy emphasis on live demonstrations. If you want to talk about a boa constrictor, don't show a picture of a boa constrictor. Borrow one from the zoo. If a child can be called out of the audience to wear the boa around her neck, so much the better. Such demonstrations require a lot of preparation in advance, and I soon found I had underestimated the time I'd have to commit. The rest of that year leading up to the Christmas climax was marked by frequent trips to London for planning sessions with Bryson Gore, the RI's chief technical officer, and with Richard Melman and William Woolard of the independent television company Inca, subcontracted by the BBC. Bryson was, no doubt still is, although he has moved on from the RI, a stalwart of technical ingenuity and improvisation. His fiefdom was a large workshop chaotically littered with useful rubbish, including props from earlier lecturing seasons, which, you never know, might one day come in handy. It was his job to make or supervise the making of apparatus and other necessaries for the lectures, not just the Christmas lectures, but the Friday evening discourses and many more. It was a trifle unfortunate that his given name sounds like a surname, so the audiences might have thought I was being old-fashioned when I addressed him as Bryson during the lectures. In earlier times, indeed, lecturers had referred to his predecessor as Coates. Bryson's services and those of his staff, a young man called Bipin, were placed at my disposal, and I had to think hard and discuss with Bryson and William and Richard how to use them. One agreeable and unanticipated feature of the Christmas lectures was that the very name was a golden key to unlock goodwill, whichever way I turned. You want to borrow an eagle? Well, that's difficult. I honestly don't see how we can realistically... I mean, do you seriously expect... Oh, you're giving the Royal Institution Christmas lectures. Why didn't you say so before? Of course, how many eagles do you need? You want an MRI scan of your brain? Well, who is your doctor? Have you been referred to the MRI department on the National Health Service? Or are you going privately? Do you have health insurance? Have you any idea how expensive MRI scans are and how long the waiting list? Oh, you're doing the Christmas lectures. Well, of course, that's different. I'm sure I can slip you into a research run, no questions asked. Can you come to the radiography department on Tuesday during the lunch hour? By just dropping the name of the Christmas lectures, I managed to borrow an electron microscope, big, heavy, and transported at the lender's expense, a complete virtual reality system, whose owners went to the enormous labour of programming a simulation of the RI lecture theatre, an owl, an eagle, a hugely magnified circuit diagram of a computer chip, a baby, and a jactitating Japanese robot capable of climbing walls like a much-enlarged, ponderously hissing gecko. I chose, as the overall title of my series of five lectures, Growing Up in the Universe. I meant growing up in three senses. First, the evolutionary sense of life's growing up on our planet. Second, the historical sense of humanity's growing out of superstition and towards a naturalistic, scientific apprehension of reality. And third, the growing up of each individual's understanding from childhood to adulthood. The three themes ran through all five one-hour lectures, which were entitled Waking Up in the Universe, Designed and Designoid Objects, Climbing Mount Improbable, The Ultraviolet Garden, The Genesis of Purpose. The first lecture was typical of RI Christmas lectures in the number and variety of demonstrations. To illustrate the power of exponential growth of a population under hypothetical conditions of unlimited food and no constraints, I used the example of folding paper. Every time you fold paper, you double its thickness. If you fold it a second time, your paper is four times as thick as the original. Successive foldings increase the thickness until you reach the sixth fold, 64 pages thick. Regardless of the size of the paper you start with, six foldings is normally as far as you can go. The wad is too thick to fold again, and by now very small in area. But if you were somehow able to continue folding, even as few as 50 times, the thickness of your paper would reach out to the orbit of Mars. This being the Christmas lectures, it was not enough to state the calculation. It was necessary to roll out a huge piece of paper and call up a pair of children to help fold it, only as far as 64-fold thickness, after which they struggled amid laughter. I suppose it's a good way to drive home the power of exponential growth, but throughout my Christmas lectures I occasionally worried that a simile can obscure rather than illuminate the simuland. Look it up if you must, and as I confess I did, but you'll find that you already know the meaning imbibed in the way we learned our words as children. The first lecture also demonstrated what could be called faith in the scientific method. Bryson hung a cannonball on a wire from the high ceiling of the steeply raked RI lecture theatre. I stood to attention against the wall, held the cannonball to my nose, then let go. You have to be careful not to give it a shove, but if you just let it go by gravity, the laws of physics assure you that when it swings back, it will stop just a tiny bit short of breaking your nose. It requires a modicum of willpower not to flinch as the black iron ball looms up against you. I'm told, by no less an authority than a former president of the Royal Society, who happens to be Australian, that when this demonstration is performed by Australian scientists, only wusses hold the cannonball to their face. Top blokes hold it to their lolly bags, budgie smugglers or jocks. And I heard of a Canadian physicist who was so exhilarated by the audience's burst of premature applause as the cannonball hurtled towards him that he started forwards to acknowledge it. I also, in Lecture 1, borrowed a baby, Richard Melman's niece, in order to hold her in my arms while I told of Michael Faraday's famous retort to the question, What is the use of electricity? He said, although the story is attributed to others as well, of what use is a newborn baby? I found myself sentimentally affected to be holding the beautiful little Hannah while I spoke, with hushed voice in order not to frighten her, of the preciousness of life, the life that stretched before her. I was delighted when, some 20 years later, Hannah announced herself on a correspondence forum on my website, richarddawkins.net. Another sentimental memory that I especially treasure is from Lecture 5. I was talking about a revealing difference between two ways in which the retinal image can move. If you shut one eye and gently poke the other eyeball through the lid with your finger, and I asked the children to do this to themselves, the whole scene appears to move as if in an earthquake. But if you move your eyeballs using the dedicated muscles attached to them for that purpose, you don't see an earthquake, even though the retinal image has moved just as if you'd poked your eyeball. The world seems to stay rock steady, you just look at a different part of it. One explanation offered by German scientists is that when the brain gives the order to swivel the eyeball in its socket, it sends a copy of the order to the part of the brain that perceives the image. This copy primes the brain to expect the image to move through the precise amount ordered. So the perceived world looks steady because there's no discrepancy between observed and expected. When you poke your eyeball, no copy is sent, so the world appears to move as if it really has moved, as in an earthquake, because now there is a discrepancy between observed and expected. I pretended I was going to demonstrate the effect with a key experiment. I would paralyze the eyeball-moving muscles with an injection. Then, when the brain sent an order to move the eyeball would stay still, but the copy of the instruction would still be issued. So the person would see an apparent earthquake, even though the eyeball hadn't moved, the apparent movement being the discrepancy between expected and actual zero eye movement. This being the Christmas lectures, the next thing to do was to call for a volunteer. I produced a huge veterinary hypodermic syringe fit to sedate a rhinoceros and asked who would like to take part in the experiment. Normally, the children at the Royal Institution lectures fall over themselves in their eagerness to assist in demonstrations. Surely nobody would volunteer in this case, and I was about to reassure everyone that it was only a joke, when one little girl of 7, probably the youngest in the audience, hesitantly raised her hand. It was my darling daughter Juliet, sitting shyly by her mother. I still choke up a little at the memory of her uncomprehending loyalty and courage in the face of the monstrous hypodermic that I was brandishing. Is it irrelevant that she is now a promising young doctor? Moving from my smallest volunteer to my largest, in Lecture 4 I was talking about our moral attitudes to animals and the history of our exploitation of them. I quoted the Oxford historian Keith Thomas on medieval beliefs that animals existed purely for our benefit. Lobsters were furnished with claws so that we could benefit from the improving exercise of cracking them. Weeds grew because it was good discipline for us to have to work hard pulling them up. Horseflies were created so that men should exercise their wits and industry to guard themselves against them. The willing ox of himself came home to the slaughter with the lamb, and every beast did thither bring himself to be an offering. Douglas Adams extended this conceit to a surreal conclusion in The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, where a large meaty quadruped of the bovine type approached the table, announced itself as the dish of the day, and encouraged diners to try something off the shoulder, perhaps, braised in a white wine sauce? Or a casserole of me, perhaps? It goes on to explain that people had become so worried about the morality of eating animals that it was eventually decided to cut through the whole tangled problem and breed an animal that actually wanted to be eaten and was capable of saying so clearly and distinctly, and here I am. The majority of the restaurant party ordered rare steaks all round, and the animal happily trotted off to the kitchen to shoot itself, humanely. I needed somebody to read this darkly humorous and philosophically profound piece, and here yet again was my cue to call for a volunteer from the juvenile auditory. Dozens of eager hands shot up as usual, and I pointed to one. An enormous man uncoiled his near 7-foot height, and I beckoned him to the front. "What's your name?" "Douglas." "Douglas what?" "Adams." "Douglas Adams, what an amazing coincidence." The older children at least realised it was a plant, but it didn't matter. Douglas gave a wonderful performance as the dish of the day, complete with mimed gestures when he reached, "Or the rump is very good. I've been exercising it and eating plenty of grain, so there's lots of good meat there." Although most of the props for my lectures were conjured up by Bryson and his staff, I also pressed my artistic mother into service. In Lecture One, I was trying to convey an intuitive idea of the immensity of geological time. Many analogies have been proposed, and I've used several myself on different occasions. As others have before, here I chose to represent time by distance, one pace per 1,000 years. My first few steps across the stage took us back through William the Conqueror, Jesus, King David, and various pharaohs. But by the time we had got back to the creatures we now find as fossils, the theatre was too small, and so I translated the paces into miles, making the numbers vivid by naming towns that were the appropriate distance away: Manchester, Carlisle, Glasgow, Moscow. For each fossil I named, my mother had painted a reconstruction of it on a large sheet of cardboard. Bryson had planted these portraits on particular children at strategic places in the auditorium, and they stood up as I called on them. My parents also made a lovely model of Mount Improbable, the eponymous mountain of Lecture Three, and my later book of that name. One side of the mountain is a sheer precipice. The impossible feat of leaping from the bottom to the top is equivalent to evolving a complex organ like an eye in one fell swoop. But round the back of the mountain is a gradual slope from bottom to top. Climbing step by step up the slope is how evolution works, cumulative selection. There's a picture of this lecture in the E appendix, in which you can just see Mount Improbable behind me, and also Bipin and Bryson. Why am I wearing a Second World War helmet in that picture? The lecture ended with a classic RI demonstration, the great Bombardier Beetle damp squid display. The Bombardier Beetle is the creationist's favourite insect. It defends itself against predators by squirting hot vapour produced by a chemical reaction. No wonder the reagents are kept in separate glands and not exposed to each other until they are squirted out of the beetle's rear end. Creationists love it because they think the intermediate ancestral stages would all explode, rendering the evolution impossible. My demonstration, carefully prepared by Bryson, showed that actually there is a gentle slope up this particular peak of Mount Improbable. The reaction, which depends upon the reactivity of hydrogen peroxide, requires a catalyst, and there is a smooth dose-response curve. Without the catalyst, there is no perceptible reaction at all, and I made much of the anticlimax to mock the creationist alarmism. Then I had a series of beakers of ingredients on the bench, and I added increasing doses of catalyst to each. With a small amount of catalyst, the peroxide gets gently warm. Increasing doses of catalyst smoothly increase the strength of reaction until, with a large dose, the audience was able to applaud a satisfying whoosh of steam towards the ceiling, and the effect would surely alarm and probably burn any predator brave enough to attack a bombardier beetle. Of course, these being the Christmas lectures, I hammed it up, putting on a safety helmet and inviting nervous members of the audience to leave the room. None did. In all my years as a university lecturer, I have never come close to matching the rehearsing and drilling, almost choreography, that the Christmas lectures put me through. William and Richard seemed to mastermind my every move. As the months of preparation drew towards their December climax, and enormous BBC outside broadcast trucks drew up outside the RI in Albemarle Street, William and Richard were joined by Stuart MacDonald, the BBC's own stage manager, whose job was to direct the actual televising, deployment of cameras, etc. Stuart, William and Richard pulled my puppet strings, and Bryson's too, for he was up and down throughout the lectures, bringing on and taking off props ranging from fossils to totem poles to giant model eyes, and in many cases helping me to handle them. The choreography inevitably broke down when we had live animals, and there was a moment of comedy when Bryson and I were trying to catch stick insects walking all over my ridiculously flowery shirt. Things got out of hand again when, to illustrate the power of artificial selection, we had representatives of contrasting breeds of dogs brought on by their rather forthright owner, who corrected me with justified brusqueness when I referred to her prized German shepherd as an Alsatian. The five lectures were spaced at intervals of about 2 days, and each one was rehearsed in full 3 times before being finally delivered, 2 rehearsals the day before, then full dress rehearsal the morning before the evening performance. I suppose actors get used to this, but I'm surprised I didn't get bored by the repetition. It meant that I gave each of the 5 lectures 4 times in quick succession, making 20 hours of lecturing in all. I confess that I was getting a bit weary by the end of the 3rd rehearsal in each case, but the sight of a live audience, what Lala tells me is called Doctor Theatre, soon dispelled that. I spent so long in the Royal Institution during my year that I still have a sense of cosy familiarity, almost like coming home, whenever I visit the place. I suspect other Christmas lecturers feel the same. I was told, and this again must be true of all RI Christmas lecturers, that during my week, my face had more hours of exposure on British television than any other. Those hours were well away from peak time, however, so didn't result, I'm glad to say, in my being recognised in the street. Islands of the Blessed. Japan. A tradition has grown up of exporting the RI Christmas lectures to Japan the following summer, and I gladly went along with the custom. They were still called the Christmas lectures, even in June, and the series was abridged from 5 to 3. Each of my 3 was given twice, however, once in Tokyo and once in Sendai, a large provincial capital city 2.5 hours north of Tokyo by bullet train. It was agreed that Lala could come with me, and she helped me work on abridging the 5 lectures. Bryson flew on ahead of us with a large crate of props from the London performances. In Tokyo, he met up with his opposite number there, employed by the British Council as our local scientific fixer, and they set to work sourcing materials and animals for the demonstrations. The Japan lectures were not filmed, at least not for broadcasting, so the choreography didn't have to be so perfect, and there was no William Woolard or Richard Melman to do it anyway. This was perhaps just as well, as we did not in all cases have the same props and walk-on parts, or in one case slither-on, because we hired a python from an animal supply house. This raised unexpected difficulties. In the first place, the snake arrived in a box labelled in Japanese, Live Turtles. This was because the supply house feared that the parcel delivery workers would refuse to handle a box if it was labelled Live Snake. We were warned that it was highly unlikely that any Japanese child would volunteer to handle it, so Lala was drafted in to make a rather spectacular entrance wearing the snake coiled menacingly around her body. The python had arrived packed in frozen Brussels sprouts to keep it inactive. By the time of the lecture, and no doubt benefiting from Lala's body heat, it had become quite frisky. It escaped and started sliding swiftly about, with Lala, Bryson and me in energetic pursuit, and the children startled into either nervous silence or horrified cries of alarm. Undaunted, we stuck with the RI tradition of few slides and lots of demonstrations. There was a tank full of live praying mantises, projected by video camera upon a huge screen above my head. Once I'd finished talking about them, I moved on to something else, having forgotten that they were still up on the screen. Somewhat later, I became uneasily conscious that I was losing my audience. Even allowing for the fact that they were listening to a simultaneous translation with a delay, they didn't seem to be responding to my words as I might have hoped. Then I noticed that their eyes were bulging in fascination towards something above my head. I looked up at the screen to see a giant female mantis happily munching. It really is a suitable word for those splendid jaws, the severed head of her sexual partner. What was left of him was still gamely copulating with her, possibly the more gamely for having lost his head. There is some evidence that sexual behaviour in male insects is inhibited by nerve impulses from the brain. My friend and flatmate Michael Hansel was once giving a talk about his caddisfly larvae and expressed regret that he couldn't persuade the adults to breed in captivity. At this, the professor of entomology, the endearingly cantankerous George Varley, growled almost contemptuously from the front row, "Haven't you tried cutting their heads off?" The video feed from the mantis tank was too much of a distraction. Killjoy that I was, I asked the technicians to switch it off. Compared with London children who were falling over themselves with eagerness to volunteer for the demonstrations, the Japanese children were far more shy. Perhaps, too, they were intimidated by the vast size of the auditoriums, which in both Tokyo and Sendai were frighteningly much bigger than the RI Theatre in London. And I suppose it would have been difficult to handle the language problem. Anyway, for whatever reason, hardly any Japanese children volunteered in either Tokyo or Sendai. I don't remember how we managed this in Sendai, but in Tokyo, the volunteers on almost every occasion were the same, the three delightful daughters of the British ambassador, Sir John Boyd. Sir John and Lady Boyd invited Lala and me and Bryson to dinner in the residence. Afterwards, Julia Boyd and the three girls took us for a night-time swim in the embassy pool. Sir John was visibly uncomfortable at this, because it was against the rules and, as a newly appointed ambassador, he feared he was not setting a good example to his staff by letting his family break them. On the other hand, his guests were obviously having a nice time, and he is a wonderfully generous host. This was the beginning of a lovely friendship with the Boyd family, which has continued to this day. 2 years after the Japanese Christmas lectures, I was awarded the valuable Nakayama Prize for Human Sciences, and Lala and I went back to Tokyo for the presentation. The Boyds invited us to stay at the residence, and we were delighted to accept, although the hotel would no doubt have been very luxurious too. There happened to be an earthquake while we were there. Lala and I were in our bedroom and were somewhat alarmed to see the walls shake and the chandeliers swing. We were reassured when His Excellency himself came through the door with the broad grin of a man who's seen it all before, waving a pair of safety helmets for us. At breakfast next morning, a visiting British Member of Parliament, who was also staying at the embassy, indulged the obvious wisecrack when Lala and I walked in. "And did the earth move for you last night?" The Boyds graciously came to the Nakayama prize-giving ceremony. I don't remember much about it, except for the group photograph which was taken afterwards. The photographer had an assistant, impeccably neat and bustling smart, in a little black suit. It was this petite young woman's job to line us all up for the photograph, and she took it very seriously. Those of us sitting in the front row had to have our hands precisely folded in our laps, all with the same hand on top. Our knees had to be held tight together and our shoes precisely aligned. John Boyd and I, having had our limbs adjusted in the middle, became aware of suppressed giggles and snorts of laughter to our right. We dared a quick look away from our regimented eyes-front position and were rewarded with a sight to remember. Our wives, sitting together, were being sorted out by the photographer's assistant. But whereas we males only had to have our shoes and knees lined up, the ladies had to have their tights straightened too. And to do this, the photographer's assistant was reaching up inside their skirts. Hence the poorly suppressed giggles. By the time of Lala's and my next trip to Japan in 1997, John Boyd's ambassadorship had come to an end, so we were denied the pleasure of another stay in the embassy compound, although the new ambassador did kindly host a reception for us. John Boyd went on to become a very successful master of Churchill College, Cambridge, and I'd love to take some credit for calling the college's attention to his excellent qualities. I was back in Japan to collect another award, the even more lucrative International Cosmos Prize, and it was an enormous honour, the ceremony to take place in Osaka in the presence of the Crown Prince and Princess. I was asked to choose a piece of music which the court orchestra would play in my honour. There was a strict time limit for the music, which restricted my choice. I sought advice from Lala's old friend Michael Burkitt, and after a lot of thought he suggested a suite of exactly the right length by Schubert, who by happy coincidence happens to be my favourite composer. It had the advantage of a provocative change of mood halfway through, and the orchestra performed it beautifully, contributing to making the whole occasion, including a private tea with the Crown Prince and Princess, and the prize-giving ceremony itself, extremely gracious. Here are the opening paragraphs of my formal acceptance speech. You may guess from the wording how much help I must have received from the professional diplomats of the British Embassy. Your Imperial Highnesses, ladies and gentlemen, it is a great pleasure to be here, and I'd like to start by expressing my sincere gratitude to their Imperial Highnesses, the Crown Prince and Princess, for attending today's ceremony. I'm especially grateful to the Crown Prince for his gracious and very thoughtful words. His speech had recalled his 2 years at the University of Oxford. I'd also like to express my appreciation to the Prime Minister for sending his message of congratulations today. Three paragraphs of diplomatic thanks cut here. Anyone with a passing interest in Japanese history and culture is aware of the importance that the Japanese place on harmony with nature. The traditional Japanese arts, whether it be archery, calligraphy, or tea-making, all have at their core the endeavour by the individual to achieve harmony with the world. The four seasons are each celebrated in their own way and provide much of the inspiration for Japanese art and design. I myself feel positively Japanese when I think of the delight that you take in the pleasures of viewing cherry blossom in the spring or gazing at the autumn moon. On the other hand, the world's view of Japan in recent decades is of a country driven by technology and wealth creation. We have looked on in admiration and some envy as a seemingly endless stream of impressive new products has flowed from Japan's factories. In the process, you have built up the second largest economy in the world. But I know that the Japanese government is also moving actively to promote basic curiosity-driven science. I confidently expect that the next century will see a great flowering of basic scientific research in Japanese universities and institutes, including, in accordance with the aims of the Foundation, research on the environment and its problems. Impressive as Japanese achievements have been to date, I have a feeling that, to borrow an English colloquialism, we ain't seen nothing yet. For the public lecture that I later had to give on a scientific subject, I chose as my topic The Selfish Cooperator, and later expanded the speech to become the chapter of that name in Unweaving the Rainbow. I love going to Japan, although I confess to being squeamish about some of the raw food, such as the raw Holothurian guts to which I was introduced on my very first visit to the country in 1986. I was there as one of half a dozen scientists invited to give supporting talks at a conference in honour of Peter Raven, distinguished botanist and very nice man whom I hadn't met before and who was being awarded the International Prize. On this occasion I was also introduced to karaoke, which did not impress me any more than the raw fish, and to the contemplative peace of Kyoto's temples, which did. To my shame, I have never achieved any dexterity with chopsticks. How does even an expert tackle a dish consisting of nothing but a whole large turnip, sitting solitary and proud in a bath of water? I was completely baffled by this very conundrum at one formal dinner, where I was the guest of honour under the eyes of some 20 other guests, at long, low tables arranged in a hollow square around two chalk-white geishas performing the tea ceremony. I'm afraid I simply gave up. But as far as I could see, none of the other diners made any significant inroads into their turnips either. My most recent visit to Japan was in quest of a prize of a different kind, the giant squid. I had become friendly with Ray Dalio, brilliant financier and enthusiast for science. In pursuit of his passion for marine biology, he had bought a beautiful research vessel, the Alusia, and had now teamed up with two television companies, one in Japan and one in America, in a search for the giant squid, fabled sea monster of yore, in the deep seas off Japan. Dead or nearly dead specimens or bits of them had been brought up in trawls, but Ray was inspired by the small band of dedicated biologists from Japan, New Zealand and America and elsewhere, who for decades had been trying to find a giant squid alive and swimming in its natural habitat, the deep ocean. The Alusia was prepared for action. Expert biologists from all over the world were mustered, and to my great joy, Ray invited me along for the ride. The expedition was highly confidential, and I was sworn to secrecy, because the two television companies, in the event that they succeeded in filming a live giant squid, wanted to save the news up for maximum impact. Unfortunately, that trip was postponed. I forgot about it and went about my normal business. Then, some months later, in the summer of 2012, I received a telephone call out of the blue. It was Ray. Characteristically, he didn't beat about the bush. "Ray, can you get on a plane to Japan tomorrow?" Me, Why, have you found the giant squid? Ray, I'm not at liberty to say. Me, right, I'll be there. And I was, although it wasn't literally the next day, more like a week. Fact struggles to keep up with fiction. Ray explained that I would have to take a 28-hour ferry ride from Tokyo to the Ogasawara archipelago, where the Alusia was anchored. These volcanic islands are sometimes known as the Galapagos of the Orient. Like Galapagos, they've never been part of a continent, and they've evolved their own unique flora and fauna. But they are much older than Galapagos, and the plate tectonic forces that created them placed them near the Mariana Trench, where the seafloor is further below the surface than anywhere else on the planet. I still didn't officially know that they had already found a giant squid, and I scrupulously kept silent about the suspected reason for my precipitate summons. Only Lala knew why I had flown so suddenly to Japan, and she too maintained strict secrecy. To no avail, at least on one occasion. She met David Attenborough at a social event, and he asked after me. Lala replied that I was on a ship in Japanese waters. "Oh," said Sir David without hesitation, "he's obviously after the giant squid." So much for our careful reticence. After the long flight, I spent a night in a Tokyo hotel before boarding the ferry together with Colin Bell, an Australian friend of Ray's, who was also bound for the Alusia. We shared a cabin. Most of the very numerous passengers slept on futons on the floor in large dormitories. I can't remember how we passed the time, reading, I suppose. When we docked, we were met by members of the Discovery Channel team from the Alusia, and a little later we were in a small boat speeding out to where the ship was riding at anchor. The Alusia has a large, wet loading bay at the back, on which are perched its two submersibles, a Triton and a Deep Rover, and there was a large party of rather wet people standing there as we arrived. These included Ray, who greeted us warmly. We still didn't officially know that they'd found a giant squid, but Ray tipped us the wink when we arrived and said that they'd organised a seminar on board that very evening to talk about the momentous discovery and how it was made. Meanwhile, would we like to go to the bottom of the sea? Of course we would! Right then, be ready in 10 minutes. I was to go down in the Triton three-person submersible, Colin in the two-person Deep Rover. The highly skilled pilot in the Triton was Mark Taylor, an Englishman, and my fellow passenger was Dr. Tsunemi Kubadera of Tokyo's National Museum of Nature and Science. He had been the scientist mainly involved in the live sighting of a giant squid, and I think this wasn't the only reason Mark treated Dr. Ku with enormous respect underwater, as everyone did on the surface. The three of us climbed through the open hatch of the Triton while it was still on board the Alusia, and took our seats in the spherical, transparent bubble. Mark on a raised seat, behind Dr. Ku on the left and me on the right. The hatch was securely battened down, and then the Triton was lifted on a hoist and deposited into the sea, where we bobbed around waiting for the similar launch of the Deep Rover. I was entranced by the sight of the blue water the other side of the bubble as we danced around in the waves. Mark gave us a routine safety briefing, an explanation of how our life-preserving hydrostat worked, including an interesting technical difference between our own craft and Deep Rover. He explained that we would be at normal atmospheric pressure throughout, despite the megapascals that would soon assail the outside of our bubble. We would therefore need no special precautions against the bends when resurfacing, even though we were going down 700 metres. It would have been too much to hope that Dr. Ku would see a giant squid again on the dive that I did with him, but we did see some ordinary squid, and lots of fish including sharks, jellyfish, rainbow-shimmering tinafores and much else that might populate a zoologist's dreams. That evening, in the saloon of the ship, the zoologists of the expedition gave us the promised seminar on the science behind the successful filming and sighting of the giant squid. There were two illustrated talks. The first was by Dr. Edith Widder, a marine biologist good enough to have won a MacArthur Genius Award. She's an expert on bioluminescence, and she knew that at the sort of depths giant squids favour, the only light is generated by living creatures, often actually by bacteria, that they carefully cultivate in luminescent organs for the purpose. Unlike the whales with which they share the deeps, giant squid have giant eyes, so they probably hunt at least partly by sight. Such considerations led Edie to invent the electronic jellyfish, a luminous lure designed to appeal to giant squid. It succeeded brilliantly. Lowered together with an automatic camera and towed behind the ship on a 700-metre cable, it bided its time with ultimate climactic success. The spectral, almost nightmarish shape of the giant squid pouncing on the luminous bait is a sight I cannot forget. Also unforgettable is the film of Edie's face as she later scanned her way through the huge computer files of empty images and suddenly saw the legendary sea monster powering in from the side of the frame. She and her colleagues were filmed by the television crew as they stared at the computer screen, and their facial expressions and exultant cries made me tremble with the joy of vicarious discovery. Even if, as killjoys can be relied upon to suspect, the scene was reenacted later. The second talk at that extraordinary seminar in the Eleusis Saloon was by Steve O'Shea, a New Zealand marine biologist who, like Tsunami Kubadera, had devoted much of his life to the quest for the giant squid. His ingenious idea for a bait focused on a different sense from Edith Widder's electronic jellyfish, smell. He made a puree of ground-up squid in the hope that the smell, especially sex pheromones, would lure the giant through the darkness. It wafted in an alluring cloud from a pipe attached to the submersible and did indeed prove to be an effective squid magnet, but unfortunately for ordinary smaller squids only. No giant squid joined them. The final success in actually seeing a live giant squid fell to Kubadera, as O'Shea went on to describe. Dr. Ku himself, although he speaks English, didn't feel confident enough in the language to present the talk. Kubadera's lure was more like a traditional angler's bait. A diamondback squid, pretty large in its own right, though not in the same class as a giant squid, baited the line tethered to the submersible. And mirabile dictu, it worked. Dr. Ku himself was in the submersible, the very Triton that I was to share with him a few days later, and saw the Kraken seize the bait and hold on to it for long enough to provide splendid footage for the cameras. His return to the surface was an emotional moment, as the television broadcast later showed. It seemed that the whole ship's crew turned out to pipe Dr. Ku aboard and cheer this climax to a lifelong quest, generously congratulated by Edie and Steve. And damn, I missed it by a mere couple of days. A minor misfortune supervened. My expected week on the Eleusia with further dives promised was cut short by the news that a dangerous typhoon was revving itself up in the vicinity and on its menacing way towards us. I was present when the captain advised Ray Dalio that we had no choice but to hightail it to the shelter of Yokohama Harbour, 2 days sailing away. That was a big disappointment for Colin and me, who had only just arrived. Nevertheless, those 2 days fleeing the typhoon were great fun. I gave a seminar on evolution in the saloon one evening, and Ray himself treated us to an informal breakfast tutorial on the truth behind the financial crisis, which I found riveting, as I always do when I listen to somebody who really knows his own subject and can talk about it from first principles. Arthur C. Clarke, best known for his mind-stretching stories about outer space, has suggested that the deep sea is almost as mysterious, although it's on our very doorstep. My brief forays into that alien world, both then and in a later trip in 2014 to Raja Ampat off New Guinea, again as Ray Dalio's guest on the Eleusia, have been among the great privileges of my life. That second trip was not aimed at any particular biological discovery, like that of the giant squid, but Raja Ampat is one of the great unspoiled marine areas, breathtakingly beautiful, and with a marine fauna as rich as anywhere in the world. This time I enjoyed numerous dives in the Triton, sometimes with Mark Taylor as pilot, sometimes with one or other of his two colleagues. I was delighted that my fellow guests on this second trip included Larry Summers, the immensely distinguished economist and former president of Harvard, with his literary wife Lisa New. Mealtime conversations were an intellectual feast, with Larry the academic economist and Ray the preeminent practitioner of the markets, playing off each other. Not that such subjects dominated. There were world-class experts on conservation aboard, and theirs was a topic that preoccupied us all. One of these experts was Peter Seligman, chairman of Conservation International, and my cabin mate on this trip. Another was the American biologist Mark Erdman. Mark knew these islands like the palm of his hand, and he was invaluable as our Indonesian interpreter. He was on a quest for a particular rainbow fish in a river deep in the forest of West Papua, which he suspected was a hitherto undescribed species. He also suspected that it would turn out to be unrelated to other fish in the same region, but closely related to fish from the other side of the great island of New Guinea. If true, this would have great zoogeographic significance, as it would tell us something about shifting tectonic plates carrying these freshwater fish with them. The Alusia anchored offshore, and the ship's onboard helicopter ferried relays of us inland and upriver to take turns in assisting Mark in searching for his rainbow fish. The repeated drill was as follows. Mark would wade out into the fast stream, holding one end of the net. One of us, Ray or I, or whoever was on that shift, would also wade out, a bit further downstream, holding the other end of the net. We crouched down in the pleasantly cool water, and then, on a word of command from Mark, we stood up and pulled the net rapidly towards the bank, trapping whatever fish might have swum into it. We'd then lay the net out on the shore, and Mark would inspect the contents for his rainbow. When my turn came around on the second shift, Mark was in place with his net when we landed on a sandbank in the river. We set about the search and success! The day's catch amounted to some 15 of the little fish, and Mark's expert eye confirmed that they were indeed of the hitherto unnamed species that he had suspected. They were carefully kept alive in a tank, pending his formal description of their details, including DNA analysis, and of course the all-important conferring of a scientific name on the species. As it happened, I had a personal interest in the naming of fish. I had felt highly honoured when, in 2012, a team of Sri Lankan ichthyologists conferred the scientific name Dawkinsia on another genus of freshwater fish, this one from Sri Lanka and South India. There are now 9 recognised species in the genus. The beautiful one shown in the E appendix, it too might seem to deserve the name rainbow fish, is Dawkinsia roani. Galapagos. If Ogasawara is the Galapagos of the Orient, for me part of its attraction lay in my love affair with the Galapagos archipelago itself. It's a place of pilgrimage for Darwinians such as me, so it was perhaps not surprising that Victoria Getty, when she happened to meet Lala at a grand dinner in Windsor Castle, was shocked to learn that I'd never been there. So shocked, in fact, that she immediately promised to put this right by arranging a trip to the islands and inviting us along as her guests. This serendipitous conversation had come about at a gala occasion hosted by Prince Michael of Kent, which featured the performance by a visiting Russian orchestra of a symphonic work composed by Gordon Getty, younger brother of Victoria's late husband, Sir Paul Getty. Prince Michael is a prominent Russophile. I was impressed by his speech of welcome to the orchestra in Russian. He and Princess Michael are friends of Charles Simoni, my benefactor at Oxford, through whom we had been invited. The dinner stands out in my memory not only because of Lala's conversation with Victoria Getty, but because I sat next to Susan Hutchison, former television news anchor in Seattle and executive director of Charles's charitable foundation. I found her charming and delightful company until I discovered that she was a shamelessly enthusiastic supporter of George W. Bush, whereupon my gentlemanly manners were sorely tested. We didn't quite come to blows, and by the end of the meal we had kissed and made up. Meanwhile, Victoria had asked Lala what Galapagos was like, and Lala said she hadn't been there, and I hadn't either. There and then, Victoria promised Lala she would arrange a trip and invite us along as her guests. The very next day, she telephoned Lala to say she was looking at chartering a boat called the Beagle, a facultative sailing boat, but otherwise not like the original one, and to fix the date of the voyage. We were overjoyed. Then something embarrassing happened. Well, an embarras de richesse, you'd have to call it. Completely independently, I was approached by an American shipping magnate, Richard Fain. One of his ships, the Celebrity Expedition, plied the Galapagos Islands, and he had chartered it to celebrate an anniversary with his wife, Colette, in the company of 90 friends and relations. Would I like to come on board as guest lecturer to regale his guests with talk of evolution in the very place where Darwin had his first stirrings of inspiration, the place about which Darwin wrote those haunting words, One might almost fancy that from an original paucity of birds in this archipelago, one species had been taken and modified for different ends. Lala was invited too, and so also when I told Mr. Fane that I couldn't go because I'd missed Juliet's birthday, was Juliet. It was too tempting and generous an offer to pass up. But what to say to Victoria? She had arranged the trip on the Beagle as a consequence of discovering that I had never been to Galapagos. But now, if we accepted Richard Fane's invitation, our participation in the Beagle voyage would be founded on false premises. It would be my second visit, not my first. We decided we had to come clean. Lala telephoned Victoria to confess all. She responded extremely generously, simply saying, "So much the better, you'll be able to explain things to us." Her generosity continued the next time we met, which was at one of the cricket matches that she organised to honour the tradition of her late husband. That Anglophile American, he became indeed a naturalised British citizen, was so passionate about cricket that he carved out from a hillside in his Buckinghamshire estate a first-class pitch where county teams would come to play against, among other teams, the Getty 11. After his death in 2003, Victoria continued the custom, and we were invited each summer to one of the Getty matches, in glorious sunshine, with Getty red kites circling overhead. I call them that because Paul Getty was largely responsible for reintroducing these magnificent birds to our part of England, they having been driven extinct over most of the British Isles by gamekeepers. The cricket matches always included a sumptuous luncheon in a marquee for the guests, and we were honoured to be placed at Victoria's table, where she introduced us to Rupert and Candida Lycett Green, who were to be our fellow passengers on the Beagle. I found an immediate bond with Candida as a lifelong admirer, that's putting it mildly, of her father, the quintessentially English poet, John Betjeman. The two Galapagos voyages were both marvellous, but rather different. The celebrity expedition holds 90 passengers, and we got the full experience of the luxury cruise liner, but without the gruesome casinos and entertainments that draw passengers' attention inwards to their floating hotel, rather than out to port or starboard. The Beagle had just 9 passengers, all guests of Victoria, and we ate round one big table, together with Valentina, our cheery and knowledgeable Ecuadorian guide. Both boats followed the standard pattern of visits to Galapagos, anchoring off one island after another and ferrying passengers ashore in inflated zodiacs, strong mariners handing us on and off the little craft using the Galapagos grip. The celebrity expedition had about a dozen zodiacs, each bearing one of the excellent and knowledgeable Ecuadorian naturalists, who then supervised our walk over the island, never straying far from the beaten track. Their English, though fluent, was usually strongly accented, with one notable exception, a rakishly bearded Che Guevara look-alike, who dumbfounded us with his decorous and perfectly modulated Oxford High Table English. He had apparently been educated by missionaries. A whimsically parallel case to an experience of my friends Stephen and Alison Cobb. While in western Uganda pursuing Steve's vocation in wildlife conservation, they stopped their Land Rover in a small village, whereupon, as is the way in Africa, it was instantly surrounded by a circle of smiling children. "How are you?" the Cobbs politely asked.
"Mustn't grumble,"
came the chorused reply, presumably learned from a Yorkshire missionary. The overwhelming impression I took away from Galapagos was of the tameness of the animals and the almost Martian weirdness of the vegetation. There are regions of the world where, in the case of most members of the fauna, you feel privileged to catch a fleeting glimpse of one in the distance. In Galapagos, the tourists have to be told that you are not allowed to touch the animals. It would be absurdly easy to do so. You have to take care not to tread on the sunbathing marine iguanas and the nesting boobies and albatrosses. The Beagle, being a much smaller boat, was able to anchor off smaller islands, for example the uninhabited Daphne Major, site of Peter and Rosemary Grant's epic long-term study of evolution in the medium groundfinch. Our landing on Daphne Major was a little perilous, and I wondered how the Grants and their colleagues and students managed to offload their supplies, for everything has to be taken with them onto this deserted islet, even water. The Beagle's single zodiac was always supervised by Valentina, a member of the Cruz family, which seemed almost to have populated the archipelago all on its own. At well-nigh every island, or so we remarked jokingly to one another, we were greeted by a different one of her brothers. Another of her brothers was the captain of the Beagle. His English, although not as good as Valentina's, was probably better than he pretended. On a particularly exciting occasion, I got his meaning from the Latin. "Mola, mola!" he exulted from the helm. "Mola, mola!" One of the most extraordinary fish in the sea, the sunfish, Mola Mola, hung floating at the surface like a huge vertically suspended disc, easily visible from the deck of the boat. Captain Cruz halted the Beagle, and in a frenzy Valentina and the rest of us seized our masks, snorkels and flippers and plunged into the sea. The sunfish didn't stick around long, but it was wondrous to see it at close quarters before it vanished into its mysterious world, which was not ours. There were many lovely people on the celebrity expedition, including the Fanes themselves and their extended family of many talents. But because there were so many, we didn't get to know any of them really well. The Beagle trip with Victoria and her friends felt more intimate. Candida was unusual in that, where others would carry a camera, she carried a notebook and sat on a rock amid the scuttling Sally Lightfoot crabs, recording her thoughts, observations and impressions. I was charmed by this habit and regret that I didn't follow it myself. There is a particular poignancy in these recollections, for as I write this, Candida has just died of cancer. Each summer, she and Rupert have run the ironically named Great International Croquet Match in their beautiful and wistfully English garden, hard by Uffington's 13th century church, with its hexagonal tower overlooked by the White Horse prancing over the chalk downs, straight out of the Bronze Age. At the 2014 tournament, just a few weeks ago, Candida, knowing it would be her last, was a model of cheerful, good hostess bravery. Rest in peace, quizzical celebrant of England, an England that Charles Darwin might still recognise, thanks in part to your father. Rest in peace, enigmatically sweet shipmate and fellow explorer of the blessed islands of Darwin's youth.